And we'd like to welcome everybody back to another Football's Family podcast. And I'm kind of, as y'all know, I'm a nerd. I'm about football history and the stories of the teams. And I'm telling you what, I'm about to nerd out because I got a special guest who has a book coming out. Or is it already out?
It's already out.
Okay, so I'm going to have to get a hold of it. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Gary Myers. And on September 12th, my book, Once a Giant, A Story of Victory, Tragedy, and Life After Football was released. It's about the 86 Giants and how they've dealt with the challenges, mental, physical, emotional, financial, those challenges that occur in life after football. And I was there interview Parcells, Belichick, Lawrence Taylor, Phil Simms, Mark Bavaro, Carl Banks, Harry Carson, Phil McConkey, et cetera. The list goes on and on. And thanks so much for having me on your show.
No, Mr. Gary, I'm glad you came on. We had to find the right time. It just so happened to be 8:30 on a Friday morning or 9:30 for you in White Plains or in New York.
Yeah.
I'm just glad to be able to do that. Now, growing up, my first experience with the Giants, with that team in particular, is of all funny things, we didn't get it. A lot of games down in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
We got one game, well, actually probably two games a week on Sunday and then one on Monday. I didn't get to see the Giants much, but I was introduced to them through Tecmo Bowl. And if you ever wanted a football team that had a defense, there were two teams to pick. It was the Giants or the Bears because it was coming off of the 85 Bears. But the Giants had something that the Bears didn't have, and that was that insane – linebacker or two linebackers really that would come around the corner or right up the middle, Harry Carson and Lawrence Taylor. What brought you to write this book?
I've been wanting to do a book about life after football and the impact that this game has on these players when they get into their 50s and 60s. There's been a lot written and said about CTE, say in the last decade. And obviously that's a very, very serious issue. But the problem that these players have goes way beyond, you know, CTE. There's just, you know, mental health issues, there's financial issues, and then the physical issues that come with playing such a violent sport, you know, for an extended period of time in the NFL. And then this is my sixth book, and it's my first one about a New York team. And having grown up here and lived most of my life in New York, I've always wanted to do a book about a New York team, but I also wanted it to have national appeal. I just didn't want it to appeal to Giant fans. So this 86 team is one of the two, three, four best of the Super Bowl era.
Oh yeah, I agree.
And it had so many big names on it. And the issue that I really focus on in this book could really pertain to any team from that era, be it the 86 Cowboys, Seahawks, Browns, you name it, because although I write about the Giants, it really is shining a light on the issues that all these players from that generation are facing now that they're in the late 50s to late 60s. So I was inspired by two things. I wanted to do a book about a New York team, but I also wanted to do a book about life after football, and I wanted it to resonate nationally, that people wouldn't say, oh, I'm not interested in the Giants, so I'm not going to read this book. If you're interested in football and you're interested in the impact it has on these players' lives, once you've long forgotten about them, that was my goal in putting together this book.
Now, I don't know how personal, and again, you can tell me when's enough's enough when some of these questions, and it won't offend me.
Ask away.
Okay. With my profession, I have to be careful about what I say about people without permission. So I want to give you that same courtesy. CTE, just right off the top of my head, you dealt with a different type of football. Shoot, the 80s were different than the 70s and the 90s were different. It's just different eras. We understand that. That's not a problem. But CTE, are some of the gentlemen that you've talked to dealing with today?
Well, there's some that feel that they have the symptoms of it. As you know, it can't be 100% diagnosed
unless you're dead
posthumously.
Yeah, and that's awful.
There's a lot of studies being done and tests being done now on players. Leonard Marshall of the Giants is convinced he has it. But again, and he only recently made the decision that he was going to donate his brain after he passes to, I think it's Boston University, maybe, that has been at the forefront of this issue. But Leonard decided that he's going to donate his brain for scientific research, and he thinks that he has it. And, you know, truth be told, I think that all players from that generation have some residual issues, mental issues, you know, whether it's post-concussion syndrome or dizziness or sensitivity to light. Because, as you said before, Jeremy, this was a different era with different standards. A concussion protocol, I mean, if you said that in the 1980s, people, what are you talking about? You know, we just come to the sidelines, we get dinged or get our bell rung. And all they really did was say to you, do you know your name? Can you count to five? Do you know what stadium you're in? Do you know what day of the week it is? And if you go 4 for 4, they go, okay, you're good. Go back in the game, even though those players would be out for weeks.
Yeah, I remember that, because like I said, I started following football actually after, and you will have to correct me on this, I believe it was 1985-86 season. Was that the Broncos-Giants Super Bowl?
Yeah, it was the 86 season. The game was played in January of 87.
Okay. Thank you. I remember the next year I started following football more, you know, just like what I am now. But that game, by the way, Phil Simms was just a master. He diced my Broncos. It was pretty bad. But I remember watching those games in whatever Tennessee I can get here in Tennessee. And they say, well, he has a concussion. He'll be back soon. I mean, it's like we thought a concussion would be like a sprained ankle. You just you couldn't tape up your brain, but you could go play through it.
Yeah, when they say they'd be back soon, if you suffered in the first quarter, they meant you'll be back at the end of the first quarter. That was soon.
That's something would happen again. I'm getting off your book, but this is fascinating to me.
That's okay.
It's fascinating to me. This is something like with Troy Aikman, UCLA. I don't really know a lot of his UCLA career, but I imagine he had concussions there. But I know when he came to the Cowboys, he played through a lot. Steve Young.
Yes, sir.
He played through a lot, I believe, with the Bucks, but I definitely know with the 49ers.
Concussions ended Steve Young's career.
And he had an insane – but he was a guy the thing I remember most is, like, Jason Witten running without a helmet. Now if you have your helmet ripped off, they're like, nope, play's over. And that was a different time. For your Giants, for that team in particular, you were talking about some of the – And Bill Parcell being the coach, that was some of the nastiest. And I'm not saying this in a negative way. This is a positive statement about them. Mark Bavaro, I remember watching him as a tight end. I wouldn't want to tackle that dude.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, John Riggins once said, or no, it was Larry Zonka once said it would be smarter to hit the person than to be hit. Mark Bavaro took that to heart. I mean, you go over the middle, and there's Mark Bavaro. You're not going to hit him. You're going to say, all right, you win, bud. But you had missiles and rockets throughout the defense. I'm really surprised that you don't hear a whole lot more about that era with concussions.
Well, I mean, you've had the issues with, Dave Duerson and Andre Waters and Junior Seau.
Oh, yes. Yes, you have.
Taking their own lives. And then, you know, their brains were donated, and it was all diagnosed with CTE. And certainly they had mental issues that led them to taking their own lives. Jeremy, unfortunately, I think as time goes on here, there'll be more players coming out and talking about how they're suffering. I mean, hopefully they'll all seek help and find some kind of resolution, and that there won't be any more tragedies. But I think, and I named three players, and there are more who have taken their own lives as a result of concussions that they suffered. And the standards were just so much different then. I mean, this wouldn't happen today. At least you like to think it wouldn't happen today.
Well,
it happened with Tua last
year. It happened with Tua, and I'm like, come on, that poor kid. When you notice when his hands are like this.
Yeah.
But thank you for going. That just, to me, is fascinating. With that particular team that you're talking about, they're extracurricular. And this is a positive family show, so I'm going to – excuse me, thank you. The pollen is awful down here. This is a family show, so we're not going to talk a whole lot about their extracurricular activities. But I remember I didn't know a lot about Lawrence Taylor and what he did off the field until I heard several podcasts about it and read did he write an autobiography?
Yeah, he did.
Okay, that was where I heard it from. He was honest about a lot of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I respect that, because when men especially, and you know this, we don't talk about our problems.
Mm-hmm.
We don't. And he really, what about that team really? Did you grow up a Giants fan or a Jets fan?
Well, yeah, I actually grew up a Giants fan, but I want to mention this disclaimer for any of your audience who don't understand. Once people like myself get into the business, the newspaper business and covering a team, all allegiance to teams goes right out the window. Now, I can't speak for everybody else, you know, what's in the back of their mind. But, you know, I covered the Giants, and I moved to Dallas for 8 years, and I covered the Cowboys for the Dallas Morning News, and then I moved back to New York, and I was writing about the Giants and Jets for 29 years for the New York Daily News. The only team I root for are the Mets, because I don't cover baseball. I had zero allegiance to the Giants, the Jets, or the years I was in Dallas, to the Cowboys.
You had to be objective.
Totally. And people would say, how do you do that? And I guess I completely divorced myself emotionally from football games. Now, there are certain players that I became friendly with, and I like to see them do well because it was good for their careers. It was good for their next contract. And I like them as people. And conversely, there are some players who I really didn't like that, you know, I was indifferent towards. Now, I never want anybody to get hurt, obviously. Never, ever. But I never sat there and rooted for a team. You know, I never sat there and said, well, I hope the Giants get to the Super Bowl, or the Jets can win that AFC championship game, or the Cowboys didn't make it to a Super Bowl in the years that I was there. I was a Giant fan growing up. I went to my first game with my father, saw the Giants play at Yankee Stadium a couple of times, and I got hooked on pro football. I mean, I've always loved it, and I found it was the best sport to write about, because I love the aspect of only having to write about a game once a week, and then during the week you get to explore all the different stories, whether they were, you know, delving into a player's personality, or writing some strategy, or writing about the coach, or writing about some controversies in the locker room. It really tested your creativity to keep things interesting Monday through Saturday, when there were no games to write about. And then Sunday became a story unto itself. And, you know, you get to write about that for a couple of days and then start the process over again. But I guess this is a long way of answering to you. No. Yes, I was a Giant fan growing up, but starting in 1978, it didn't affect me one way or the other, and nor did I sit there and want a team to win.
Did you have a favorite player growing up?
Fran Tarkenton. He was only with the Giants for a few years, and they had zero success. Never made the playoffs.
It's so weird looking and seeing him in anything but purple.
I know.
So weird. And you think people hear Frank Tarkenton. Frank Tarkenton was Michael Vick before Michael Vick was Michael Vick. Just keep that in mind. He was that good. and just, but then I think he wasn't, he was traded, correct?
Yeah. Well, Fran got traded from the Vikings to the Giants. He right. spent a few years with the Giants. Tarkenton to Homer Jones is still my all time favorite combination. Quarterback receiver combination. And then Fran got traded back to the Vikings in the early 70s and made it to a couple of Super Bowls with Minnesota, but you know, obviously because the Vikings had never won a Super Bowl, they lost a bunch of them with Fran. So yeah, he was my favorite player growing up. And I mean, I've had favorite players to write about in my career with newspapers. And I've, like I mentioned before, I had favorite players as people who I keep in touch with, you know, even after way after they've retired. But so many personalities, you know, you get a locker room of 50 some odd guys, always something to write about.
It sounds like, Mr. Gary, that you took it from being a job to being personal when it comes to people. And that to me is a testament to you that they could tell not only was this a job to you, but they meant something to you.
Yeah. And I think it comes out in this book, you know, in Once a Giant, because there are so many sensitive and personal stories in here, Jeremy, that one of the most satisfying reactions I've received about the book, even from people in the business, is, boy, those guys really opened up to you. They must have really trusted you.
That's awesome. That's awesome, because you can't just say, hey, can I interview you? Well, I'm not going to tell you everything. You had to cultivate that over the years, didn't you?
Yeah, and that's where I had an edge in doing this project, is that now I moved to Dallas in December of 81, and I moved back to New York in the spring of 89. So I wasn't even in New York in 1986, but
right.
by then in Dallas, I wasn't covering the Cowboys on a day-to-day basis. I was covering the NFL, and the NFC East in those days was by far the best division.
Yes.
The NFL. So I wound up covering a lot of Cowboy Washington games, Philadelphia, Washington, Philadelphia Giants, and then a lot of the Cowboy Giant games. So I probably in 1986 covered about half the Giant games. And a lot of the players who were there in 1981, you know, mainly Phil Simms and Harry Carson and some others, were still there in 86. And then when I moved back in 89, Harry had just retired. And George Martin was another one I should add to that list. But there was a lot of players in 89 that were there in 86 who I'd gotten to know during that championship run, including Lawrence Taylor and Carl Banks and, you know, Bavaro. So when I started on this project, it wasn't like I had to introduce myself to them, or they had to get to know, well, you know, he's a good guy and I can trust him with sensitive material. I think I had that trust was already established.
Okay.
And when people read this book, as I hope they will, they'll see that come through. Basically, I don't want to say every sentence or every paragraph, but every chapter, there's something in there that I'm proud of, that they trusted me with, that I'd like to think that not a lot of people could have got them to talk about. And it wasn't like I was pulling teeth either. I mean, they were very open and honest and forthcoming with me about some of the most personal things in their lives.
When you deal with health or finances or when you deal with those things with people in general, you get a lot of people just clam up.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when you deal with men who are, I hate the word alpha because I think that's disrespectful in some ways, but we get it. Alpha male. You had you probably had a vast majority of those men who would consider themselves alpha male. If they could become honest and just tell you, yeah, this is what I did, or this is what's going on, to me, that shows how much they trust you. And that to me is awesome.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stories in the book where players opened up to me about drug use. The impact that the game has had on them. emotionally and mental health issues that Curtis McGriff, who was actually on injured reserve the entire 86 season, but was a key member of that team that was building to that moment, you know, told me in years after football that, you know, his wife was just telling him that you've changed. You know, you kind of have an anger management problem now. Not that he ever took anything, fortunately, never anything with her, but he just noticed that he got riled up much easier in different situations that he used to be, you know, easy for him to handle. And there was an instance that he was a teacher's aide at a school in northern New Jersey for kids who, troubled kids, I'd say, is the best way to describe them. And it was a small school. And one day, another teacher came into the classroom that Curtis was the teacher's aide for and said, hey, you know, Johnny or Bobby or whatever is next door in an empty classroom and he shouldn't be there. So Curtis says, I'll go get him. And he goes to the door and it's locked. And he's banging on the door and he's getting angry. And I have the details in the book. I don't know if he wound up getting the key or the kid wound up opening the door for him. I don't remember exactly what happened. And Curtis was so, and the kid was making a joke about it. And Curtis got so angry that for an instant, he thought about throwing the kid out the window. And it was on the second floor. So it wasn't like a ground floor window and obviously would have been a horrific outcome one way or the other, depending on, you know, what happened with that kid. But, you know, fortunately he caught himself. And Jeremy, the first thing he did was go down to the principal's office and resign. He said, these are kids that are coming here to be comforted and have us take care of them and show them respect and love because maybe they weren't getting it at home like they should have. And Curtis said, I'm not providing that, so I can't stay here any longer. And he goes home and calls Harry Carson, who was the captain of those giant teams during that period of time and considers himself captain for life, which is one of the heartwarming stories that come out of my book, is that players get in trouble in any way. The first call is often to Harry, who is a very wise man and players rely on him for advice. And Curtis was telling Harry that there's something the matter with him and he was thinking of ending his life. And Harry implored him to get help and said, I'm here 24/7 for you. And if these feelings don't go away, you know, let me know and I'll rush right over. But by the end of the conversation, he had calmed him down. And Curtis went and got help. And at some point in the not too long after that, he and his wife moved back to Alabama, where he's living a very happy life now. And he found the right doctor and the right medication and knows what his limitations are and doesn't put himself in difficult situations. But those are the kind of things that
that's great.
Players opened up to me about that. You just let them talk. And then I ask questions to fill in the blanks, you know, to get like time periods and things of that nature. But, you know, my book is filled, and that's a heartbreaking story, but the heartwarming part of the story, Jeremy, is how he turned to Harry Carson, a teammate, you know, and let him know that he thought he was at a very dangerous point in his life where he can do damage to himself. And Harry talked him through it and was there for him.
That's incredible. And the fact is, I don't know Harry personally, obviously you do, but the fact is that number one, he trusted Harry that much. And number two, Harry walked him through it. That's incredible. That's incredible. Now I've got just a couple more minutes. Sure. Because like I said, with Zoom, I don't want to pay them. I just don't.
Yeah, I understand.
I don't have a problem with Zoom. I just don't want to give them money. two things Number one, where can we find this book?
Yeah, I mean, this is in all the bookstores now. And the easiest thing a lot of people find these days, I love bookstores, but if you just want to sit at your computer and order it, you can do that on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. There's just, you Google it. There's I check every couple of days to see where it's available. And there are websites it's available on that I've never heard of. So, it's called Once a Giant, A Story of Victory, Tragedy, and Life After Football. And what I'm most satisfied about, it's been out for 2 weeks. It's been an Amazon bestseller for about 6 weeks now, 4 to 6 weeks. So even before it was released, it was a bestseller. I did a book signing with Phil Simms in New Jersey a couple of weeks ago. And we sold almost 560 books at one book signing, which was certainly a personal record for me. And I think it came close. This is a bookstore it's an independent bookstore in Jersey that gets a lot of big names in there. I'm not saying I'm one of them, but a couple of days after I was there, Matthew McConaughey was there. So it attracts those kind of people. And the bookstore owner told me I came close to the record of number of books.
So in New Jersey, they had a New York kid and then a Texas guy that talks about as slow as I do. That's interesting. That's interesting. I love it. Just talking with you again, I do appreciate your time. You come across as genuine and as respectful and loving, and I appreciate that because you don't get that in this society. You love what you do, and if I can use that word love again, you love the people you talk to. I'm looking, and I mentioned this earlier before we came on the air. You have two amazing posters in the back. One of them is about the catch with Dwight Clark. When you get a chance, I would love to have you on to talk about that. Because to me, I don't remember that personally, but I have watched so much NFL films that is one of the things that it was the play itself at the time, and this may not be the right word, was underwhelming in the sense he threw a ball and he caught it. But looking back and looking at everything that happened, that is one of the greatest plays in NFL history.
Yeah, it was voted, and I was part of this panel when we voted on the 100 greatest plays of the first 100 years. That was voted number 2 after the Immaculate Reception.
I can see that. But you know, at the time, you're like, he threw a ball, he caught it. It was, yeah. You're like, okay. But then doggone it, everything else on that play, they beat the Cowboys. Joe Montana with his response saying, yeah, you just beat America's team. He said, well, you can watch the Super Bowl with the rest of America.
You know, I know that story. I don't think that part happened.
You don't think that part? Oh, I would love for that part to happen. I need that part to happen, Gary. I just need that part to happen.
I know it sounds cool. I don't think Joe said that, though. But I mean, I asked him about it. He kind of laughed about it. But the amazing thing about that play, Freddie Solomon was the intended receiver, and he slipped coming off the line of scrimmage.
Really?
They had a timeout right before that play, and Bill Walsh said to Joe, basically, if things break down, don't forget about Dwight in the back of the end zone. That play, he ran to the back of the end zone, cut left, and pivoted and ran to his right. And there's this film of the 49ers actually practicing that play in training camp, because the Cowboys insist that it was kind of a schoolyard play that Dwight just improvised and that Joe was trying to throw the ball away. Cowboys to this day are convinced he was trying to throw it away. Joe is backpedaling and kind of moving to his right with Too Tall Jones, who is 6'9", coming after him. Joe pump faked it, got Too Tall in the air. On his way down, on Too Tall's way down, is when Joe threw the ball right over his outstretched hands. So it was almost like a basketball play where he faked his man into the air and then shot it over him on his way down. So in the catch book, which was my first book, I love that book, by the way. I write about how that play not, you know, changed the NFL because it was a changing of the guard.
Yes, it was.
The end of the Cowboy dynasty, so to speak, even though they didn't win a lot of Super Bowls, they were always in the championship game. It was the start of the 49ers dynasty, but also how that game affected the lives of the players who played in it. And, you know, Dwight, you know, may he rest in peace.
Yes.
Was just so cooperative and tremendous with me as I researched and did the interviews for that book that, I mean, he loved the idea of the book because it brought his name back into prominence for a while. Not that anybody will ever forget that play.
No, if you're in San Francisco, Dwight Clark and Jerry Rice or Joe Montana and all Ricky Waters, those guys are on you. This is what we call a teaser, because when he gets back on, you will be primed and ready to hear about this. Did Dwight own keep the football, or that you know of?
I know that he spiked it.
He did spike it, yes.
And, you know, I think I covered that in the book, but, I mean, that was, you know, 15, 16 years ago that I wrote the book, so I'm embarrassed to tell you I can't remember.
I can't remember yesterday, so don't be embarrassed.
Yeah, I don't remember whether one of the equipment guys got the ball back from him. That's what I think happened, but...
Now, quickly, like I said, I'm about to go out. Did the people in San Francisco get the power of that play immediately? I mean, they won the game. I get it. Or they were going to win the game, because people forget that there was another drive afterwards that almost the Cowboys almost won.
Yeah.
Did they get the? Because, like I said, it was he threw a ball, he caught it. I mean, that happens in football. Did they get the power of that play at the time?
Yeah, I think so, because it got the Niners to their first Super Bowl, and they beat the hated Cowboys, and
that's awesome.
It was an amazing play, and then they went on to beat Cincinnati in the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
But you know, one the thing that people do forget about is the Cowboys still had like 50 seconds or so,
and they nearly did it.
And Danny White throws a slant to Drew Pearson. Eric Wright grabs Pearson by the back of his neck, that today would have been a horse collar tackle, and drags him down around the 45-yard line. Cowboys continue to move, and then Danny White gets hit, dropping back, and fumbles, and the Niners recover. The Cowboys were in position where they needed about another 15 yards. Remember, they're down by 1 point. They needed about another 15 yards to kick, which in those days would have been a very long field goal of about 50 yards, by Raphael Septian, who was a very accurate kicker. And Danny fumbled and they lost the ball. If they kicked that field goal, the catch would have been remembered exactly as you're describing it. That was a pretty good catch. It was a clutch catch.
It was a clutch catch.
It was just a catch. And it didn't win the game. But because it won the game, and then the historical significance of the Niners accomplished.
The historical – Dwight Clark started with that one play, started an amazing run. You know, obviously had other teammates. I get that. But if it wasn't for that one play, we get it and we respect it. And your book, I'm looking for that too. Your book would tell about Mr. Gary, thank you for coming on, for gracing me with your presence. You are an incredible writer, incredible person, and I enjoy your stories. And I will have you back on if I could, sir.
Anytime for you, Jeremy. I really enjoyed this.
All right. Thank you for coming on and for listening to Football's Family.